Good evening, my name is John Atkin, I'm an alcoholic. I'm very enthusiastic about this program and grateful for this way of life. It's terrific. And you are a wonderful crowd, you know. You look a little suspicious. Yeah. I have a whole bunch of friends in this room that I love very much. And you have never seen me before. And in a very short while, you will know me very intimately. And that's just one of the neat things that happens in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, that we can know each other on that level. You know, we missed the Thursday night speaker, but we will listen to the tape when we go home. And last night, you know, the guy who was supposed to speak, Jon Keefe, is a very, very dear friend of mine. We have known each other for a long time, and he has more than 40 years of sobriety, and he's a dedicated AA, and we were so sad to hear that he had had an accident, but we found out today that he's all right and he's going to be fine. And you know, then I have to come to Don last night. You know, this is something. You know, you talk about the recovery, unity, and service, you know, a triangle, you know. And here's a guy with 39 years of sobriety that they just make a phone call, and he steps right in, and he gave us one hell of a fine talk. It was just a great thing. So then, you ever heard Karen this morning? Yes, I am the guilty one. You know, it could be very easy for us to stand here and talk about my wonderful Alan and my wife and my fantastic sober husband, but it wouldn't do anybody a damn bit of good. And you know, this is the beautiful part of our program, both our programs, you know, that we share our experience, strength, and hope. And in our talks, there isn't one opinion. We just talk about our experiences, and those can't be denied. And she tells her story, and I tell mine. And we don't compete. We are just grateful that we have been included in this gift of God that we have here in these rooms. And so I have to start my little deal. It can't be helped. But I come into these rooms these days, and I have some old timer that says, "Oh, him again," you know, and how it gets when you get old, you know. A couple of years ago, I was invited to Flagstaff, a roundup that's very famous out there, a fantastic, good roundup. And the guy who invited me there, he was old like myself. And I asked him, I said, "You know, you invited me here 7 years ago, 11 years ago, 19 years ago, and 27 years ago. I said, why do you invite me again?" He said, "I wanted to hear you one more time before you die." You know? It was funny then, you know. It's getting closer. Besides that, you know, I have been very active in this program ever since I came in. And I am probably the most famous substitute speaker on the West Coast. started long ago. You know, sometimes the circus speakers are invited to two different locations same weekend. And 32 years ago, Dr. Paul, you call him, God rest his soul, was invited to Vancouver, Canada, and to Hawaii the same weekend, and he was only a year sober, but he was already a circuit speaker, you know. It was just incredible. And his wife, Max, God rest her soul, it just happened, she wanted to go to Hawaii. So they said, why don't we send you on to Vancouver? Well, that was my first big deal. Came up there, Vancouver, and Corky Berg, a guy there, like Bill here, and picked up me up at the airport, and took me to, there were 4,500 people at that thing. It was a big deal. And we were standing there in the lobby, and this lady came up to Corky and said, hi, how are you? And he said, I'm really good, how are you? She said, you don't remember me, do you? He said, sure, honey, but I'm rather busy with this gentleman right now. So she left, and I said, Corky, she wanted to talk to you. You don't have to babysit me. Everybody are friendly. So why don't you go and talk to her? So he left and came back 10 minutes later and said, that's the damnedest thing I ever run into. I said, what happened? She said, I came over there and said, hi, how are you? And she said, you don't remember me, do you? I said, sure, honey, but what meeting did I meet you at? And she said, for God's sake, man, I was your second wife, you know. A little bit of a blackout, huh? I don't think I'm too presumptuous if I say that some of us here tonight sit with a bunch of burdens and lots of if onlys. But be that as it may, we all here in these rooms are still the lucky ones because we have a chance. Lots of people have this thing called alcoholism, doesn't have a chance, and for various reasons. For the record, my grandfather died from alcoholic delirium in 1910. He lived in a 2,000-acre place outside Stockholm. They were breeding racehorses, but he died from alcoholic delirium. My father had a problem with his liver in 1927, and nobody knew anything about this illness then. He was a giant of a man. He radiated vitality. Women adored him. Men envied him. But he died 3 years later, and he only weighed 130 pounds when he died. And he didn't want to die at all. I was 8 years older. I tell you, it's something to see. Beautiful human being like he once was. Because he was 6'2", and when he touched you, you realized his strength. But in 3 years, he had deteriorated to absolutely nothingness. My father was an aristocrat. He was vain and proud and arrogant. But he was also a very loving person. But there was some violence. And thanks to our program, I have been able to deal with that. 99 out of 100 meetings I go to, we finish with the Lord's Prayer. And there is a line that says, forgiven as I forgive those who trespass against me. And I assure you that there was stuff in my inventory I wish I could be forgiven about. And then we can't have two standards here. I'm supposed to be forgiven. I'm supposed to have an opportunity for a new life. But anybody that did something to me, justice for them, or whatever you want to call it, an important point. Because if we don't address this issue, we will come in as victims and we will remain victims, and it will interfere in our own recovery. And that's why I bring it up. My older brother didn't have much of a chance for another reason. He had a bit of pride, and it seems to be a commodity. We can't afford a luxury in this outfit. more than 20 years ago now. He lived in a castle out of Stockholm, married to a very beautiful girl, had a fantastic, beautiful family, and very successful. And you know, this guy, the last 18 years of his life, he lived in a room that cost $15 a month to live in, drank a fifth of whiskey every night, and has lived in the past, and there was nothing ever wrong with him. I tried to 12-step him a few times. His drunk log and mine was similarities. So I wrote him a letter, a page and a half, what I used to be like. 3.5 pages about all the wonders that has happened to me since I joined the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a postcard back. He said, "Dear John, I'm sorry to hear about all your problems." I mean, so much for identification. I flew to Stockholm in 1978 and spent a couple of weeks with him. And I invited him out here. He came out here to us in Laguna Beach. And he was here with us for a month. I took him to AA meetings. He met all our friends down, invited to the parties we had out. And Lynn Wilder had a fabulous party in his Monarch Beach home at the time, you know, and my brother was along with all of that. And he stood out with his highball of scotch in his hand and talked to all the young women in AA, and they were crazy about him. He was a very handsome guy, you know. And he had a terrific time here. And the last night, he said, before he should go back to Sweden, I said, "What do you think about this?" He said, "You don't understand. I don't want to quit. It's the only thing that's real in my life. I sit down and drink a fifth by myself every night and dream about when I was on top of everything." And I said, "I understand." And he flew home and he died 11 months later from yellow jaundice. His liver was totally gone. He was totally yellow when he finally passed away, 11 months later, you know. My younger brother has gone to Scripps twice, 22 years ago, he was there. And to make a long story short, he's still drinking. And they told him his liver was shot. And sometimes you and I wonder, what's wrong with people like my brothers? There's really nothing wrong with them. Alcohol did something for my older brother the day he died. It's still doing something for my younger brother. And that's why I say to you and I are the lucky ones. Because we have a chance. This insidious denial. I remember some years ago back, there was a guy at this podium and I loved his line. He said, "Yes, I drove down the highway in my Corvette, 140 miles an hour. I rolled it 6 times and came up on the other side and said, 'Never again am I going to buy a goddamn Chevy.'" Yeah. Ain't that how we are? No. If I get like him, I'll quit. A year later, we are there. We pick on somebody else that's worse. You know? That's how it is. I talk to newcomers. I love the feelings in these rooms when they're newcomers. And I like being a newcomer myself. I like to share how I remember when I was new and I sat down in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had about 2 weeks of sobriety and I realized that something is going on in these rooms called hope. I hope I never forget that period in my life when there was a moment of clarity and I felt part of something. I hope I never forget the last year I drank because I compromised on everything I believed in and stood for. I couldn't live a function without liquor. I didn't dare to go to sleep if I didn't have a fifth of whiskey in the refrigerator because I had to have it when I woke up. And if I ran out of booze at midnight, I usually called an associate of mine in Baldwin Park and said, "Harold, next week you will owe me $150 on this particular job, but if you give me $20 tonight, you won't have to pay me $130 next week." And I drove 100 miles round trip at midnight to pick up $20. I didn't dare to buy any booze in Baldwin Park because then I wouldn't make it home. And when I came home to Anaheim, where we lived at the time, I bought a fifth of Imperial Bourbon for $4.85. And then I was safe and I had to live like that, and I hope I never forget that period in my life. I know some of us, after we get a little well, get a few dollars in our pockets and bedroom privileges again. We forget how it really was. In fact, Karen cut me off 6 months before I came into AA. You know. She really ran out of humor down at the end, I tell you. She stood on a look, Marvin Ailey, and said, "John, I wish you could find yourself a girlfriend so I wouldn't have to fool with you." She said, "You take forever." Oh, thank you. After sobriety, we take forever. It's very commendable. It ain't really fair. I was very sensitive those days. The other reason why I like to remember that time when I was new, I had about 60 days of sobriety, and Phil Petty talked one Sunday morning, and he stood up here and said, "If you keep going to meetings, you will wake up one morning and realize and find out you can function without alcohol. And it is not necessary to drink anymore. And you have a way to go." And I sat down and said, "Jesus, I have experienced those feelings." And it was the first time I realized I wasn't hooked anymore. I had some degree of choice over my own actions. And I had already started to experience a freedom here I hadn't had for a long time. And I hope I never forget that time in Alcoholics Anonymous, the knowledge that I wasn't hooked, that I was free. I hope I never take it for granted. Those are the two reasons why I like to remember that time in my life when I was new. I didn't start to drink until I was 31 years old. It doesn't sound so promising right now, but that's how it was. But I share with you how I was when I was young. The reason why I didn't drink when I was young. When my father died, I promised my grandmother I was never going to drink, so I didn't drink. When I was 19 years old, I'd gone to college a year. The war broke out. I went in the Air Force for 2.5 years. And after that, I went back to college for 1.5 years, and I was selling at night, and I was trying to help my mom. It was very important to me to play the man or the house part, because my older brother was different. He was brilliant in school, he had scholarships to universities, and everything was laid out for him. But I was different, and I could never figure him and me out in the first place. You know, this guy, he never opened a book. He had A's in everything. I could study to 1 a.m, I still failed. It really bothered me. It's still bothering me. I'm very willing, I try real hard, and I can be good for a short time. But when the bottom fell out or something negative happened, I couldn't figure out why I was such a screw-up. When I was young, I had an unbelievable inferiority complex. I'm a perfectionist on top of it. It's not a good combination. Contemplated suicide a lot because I knew if I died, I'd be my dad. And you see, when he lived, I was security, prestige, and respect, and those things. And I tell you what I did when I was young. I faked it. I pretended I was really together. I was very noisy and opinionated, and that gave me some false courage. And that's how I was when I was young. When I was 31 years old, I was employed by this door factory in Alhambra. My boss was alcoholic, and he taught me how to drink every day. And a new life began for me. I never drank before. You know, we had early times at 8 o'clock in the morning, cocktails at 10, martini lunches from 12 to 2:30. Made a couple of calls in the afternoon and went back to the office and typed up bits from 6 to midnight blank whiskey. I thought I landed in heaven. You know, I used to come home to Karen and say, this building business is out of this world. I said, I never felt this good about myself. And you know, in retrospect, I drank a fifth of booze a day. From 2 years, I was never drunk, never hungover, I just felt good. There's something wrong with your system. You can drink that much liquor, not good. I had an enormous capacity. And my emotional being, you know, it gave me some instant courage I couldn't miss. And you know, I just tell you how screwed up I was when I grew up. When I was 12, 13 years old, I started to have a real problem with my dad dying. And I started to play games, like if I was a good kid, he was going to come back to me as a reward. And I lived in illusions and fantasies for years, all the way into my 20s. My mother started to send me to a psychiatrist when I was 12, 13 years old. And that is how I screwed up I was. And when I started to drink alcohol, you know, I had a blast. You know, and I'm going around, and the company that I represented was called Prefit Door Company, early 50s. We were the first people to manufacture pre-hung door openings, so I was in it right from the beginning. You know, and I called on the big developers, you know, Kaufman and Broad and Chappelle and Chappelle. They were building thousands of homes every year. And you know, I come in there to Mr. Chappelle's office on Wilshire Boulevard in his big office behind his big desk, and he sat down, said, it's a very interesting concept you have here, John. He said, yeah, Mr. Chappelle. I said, I think that we should stick together. He said, I didn't know you were Jewish. I said, right now I am. And he just signed the contract and laughed and said, get the hell out of here, you know. You know, that's how it was. You know, I had a blast. A year later, I sold so many doors they couldn't pay me my commission. They gave me one-third of the stock of the company. And I tell you, it was a good time in my life. And it was all thanks to booze, you know. And I mean, it was something else. And you know, you realize, I met Karen in Stockholm when she was 17 years old. And here a couple of years, we come to America in 1948. And those days, you know, I was very well off. Came from nice families in Sweden, both from my mother and father's side. And you know, we were very well off. And we came to America in 1948, right after the war. And you couldn't get any dollars. Sweden had no dollars those days. We came to Los Angeles, $150 in our pocket, start a new life. You couldn't get a job, but it was a government contract. You couldn't sign up for anything. You had to have a sponsor here that was responsible for the first 5 years here. And we didn't come in here to be the guests of America. And I tell you, you learn English real quick when you're in that spot. You know, and here we had this opportunity, and here I own part of one-third of a door factory, and what I'm going to give you now is the highlight of my drinking career. You know, when you own a place, you're a general manager, sales manager, which I was, but I was also the truck driver. I delivered all the doors I sold. And from now on, you know, here I was before, I was 2 hours a day I made calls on these people. Now I work 7 days a week, 16, 18 hours a day to make enough door opening to supply the orders we had. We had our little plant up on Palm Avenue in Alhambra. We lived in Corona del Mar at the time, a little town on the ocean there, about 6 miles away from Laguna Beach, where we have lived for over 30 years. And I'm up there in Alhambra, I'm pre-fitting these doors and loading this 2.5-ton truck. And I come home to Corona del Mar 3:30 in the morning, you know. The door should be delivered down in San Diego on Claremont Hill before 8 in the morning from house to house, you know. And I come into that little house, Karen had a hot bath ready for me, and I slid in the top down, lit a candle and inhaled, you know, and laid back down. And she came in with a pitcher of martinis. I mean, you know, 3:30 in the morning, it's really living, you know what I mean? And I lay down in that tub and I smoked that camel and I drank that martini and I spit it out the pimento, you know. You know, and then and then I said, you know, I'm just an immigrant and I own the goddamn place. You know? 8 years later, they fired me from my own door factory. We have 3 beautiful girls and a son, and we took them to church on Sundays. We did everything right to be Americans. The only problem with that church business was the last 4 years I drank. I was a morning drinker. She inspected me there in the morning before we should leave and looked at me with those little beady Allen on ice. And then she stood down and looked at me and said, not today. You know. Then she took off down the street with the kids in the car, and I had to stand down in the home alone, you know. And sometimes I ran down the block after her, screaming and hollering. My neighbors are outside talking about the lawn problem, and here I come running by, you know. Sometimes I was strangely clad, you know. She saw me in the rear view mirror coming after her in my pajamas, you know. So she stopped down the block and waited for me to roll down the windows, and I came down there. She said, what's the matter now? And I said, don't forget to pray for me. When I came down there, you know, I this time in my life, I drank 24 hours a day. In the morning, I couldn't drink whiskey right away, then I would get sick. So I discovered codeine cough medicine, you know. So I drank 2 double shots of codeine cough medicine to calm my stomach down, you know. Then I could drink a little whiskey and brush my teeth. Walked around with small steps and tried to look effective. And I sat down in church and looked sincere and hummed a lot. I could take the sermon 20 minutes max. Then I had to have a drink. After 20 minutes, I just got up and I said, screw them all. Then I went home and I drank Grand Scotch those days and played good music. Became very spiritual. Played Stan Getz and Dave Brubeck and La Boheme and Coleman Hawkins and the big bands. You know, that was my music, you know. And after sobriety, I even played Pink Floyd and Brian Ferry. Dark Side of the Moon, you know. Wow, you know. What harmonies, you know. You know, I never had any problem with alcohol until I tried to stop drinking. One day she says, you drink too much. I said, what are you talking about? She said, Johnny, you drink way too much booze. I said, then I quit, and then I couldn't quit. And that's when it all began. Because when I had been off the sauce for a couple of days, I got the shakes. And then 2 shots of booze stopped the shakes, I could function and work. So then I had to calm myself into why I had to have a couple of drinks all the time. Then I lied about it, then I was hiding. From then on, it got worse. When I was into 2-3 years of my drinking, I was up to 2/5 of whiskey a day. The last year I drank, the last 10 months I drank, it didn't matter if I drank 1/5 or 3/5. I also drank 2 bottles of codeine cough medicine every day and 6 anacins 4 times a day, and I was absolutely weird. Jesus. I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get sober, and the guilt was on all the time, and I was no relief, and I just thought I was going crazy, and I probably was. And this is a terrifying time in our life, because we can't tell nobody. I was just afraid that she was going to figure out how I had to live to function, and I knew they were going to put me away somewhere. And sometimes we talk here about the alcoholic loneliness, and there's nothing like it, because it is a total isolation. We drink to live, and we know we are dying. There's no way out of it, and that's how it is. 2 years after the shakes began, weirder things happened to me when I stopped drinking. One morning at 4 o'clock, I sat straight up in my bed and looked in front of me, and this big white snake came out of the wall. You know, I never saw anything like it in my life. He came right out of the wall, snow white, had 3 black eyes. He was this big in diameter on his fat spot. He was 23 feet long. He came slowly across the room, stopped right in front of me, and started to hiss at me. I could even smell him. Kind of a Peralta sweet mortuary deal. He smells like death. And I sat down and said to myself, you know, I haven't had a drink for 3 days, so it can't be the booze. You know? Anybody here with hallucinations? Are you all a bunch of high-bottom drunks in this outfit? You know, the closer he came, the more I screamed. And the noise in my head from my own scream reached such a crescendo, it was eventually like my brain exploded from my own screams. Then I blacked out and fell back. That was my experience with it. The next morning, Karen says to me, she says, something strange happened this morning around 4 o'clock. She said, you sat straight up, looked in front of you for quite a while, and then you said, ee. Oh, I love you. One night I made love to her when she wasn't even there. And that's kind of tricky. She was actually laying 2 feet away from me then. And she said, what are you doing over there? I said, I beg your pardon. And when she realized what was going on, she started to laugh at me. I started to cry. I felt it was so humiliating to laugh at the guy who was doing his best. In the morning, I had been out in the kitchen. I'd had my codeine coffee and my whiskey. She met me in the hallway. She said, well, good morning, lover boy. And I didn't feel any pain. I smiled at her. I said, that's the best piece I've had in a long time. You know, so it was. You know, I love the laughters in Alcoholics Anonymous. To me, that in itself is a spiritual experience. Anything that you and I have laughed about this evening was absolutely the deepest tragedy when it happened. But when you and I, in this manner of identification, talks about this is insanity and this denial, when you can laugh about all those miseries, you have an opportunity to change, you know. And it's very much part of the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that we feel that forgiveness, you know. So we started over many times, and every time I had the best of intention, and every time it got worse. And Karen told you this morning about when we went to that Palm Springs trip, and she thought I didn't love her anymore, wanted out of her and didn't know how to say it, and she drank 100 aspirins down and locked herself in a bathroom and said, I can't live like this any longer. And 2 years after that incident, I came into AA. And you can draw your own conclusion of those 2 years were on my guilt connected with it. I tried several things before I came into AA, before I came into AA. One time I swore on the Bible in front of my wife and kids. I said, I swear to God I'm never going to drink again. And, you know, that vow was very important to me. I had 13 years, 2 hours a day of religious education when I grew up. You know, 2 weeks later, I'm drinking again. I went to that minister for counseling every week for an hour for 18 months, and I leveled with him. And he told me one time, he said, you have to ask God to help you. And I said, Walter, you are a good man. I'm not. You don't talk to your wife the way I talk to mine in the evenings when she just looks a little strange at me. So God doesn't want to have anything with me. I try that stuff. When he wouldn't talk to me anymore, I went to a psychologist in Santa Ana. I spent $2,000 with his doctor. That wasn't anything he said to me that Karen didn't tell me for free 3 times a day. That wasn't anything he said to me either that wasn't the truth. Everything he said was the truth. He stood up one day and looked at me and said, you know what's wrong with you? I said, tell me, doc. And he told it all my secrets and all my emotional problems. And I said, doctor, you're absolutely right. And that's why I drink, because I can't stand myself the way I'm put together either. So then he laid on me, I hurt my wife and my kids with my deal. So what do you do then? I went on the wagon. And they tried to be at that stage, that the more sober we become, the more we realize how we hurt our loved ones. And that in itself drives us back to drinking again, because that's the only way we know how to get out from under the guilt. And so it is. Thank you. There's a lot of capable people in the field of alcoholism today, but I sure don't envy them, because the nature is still the same today as when I came in. As long as alcohol is doing something for us, it's impossible for anybody talking out of using it. And that's the nature of the illness, and that's why I said in the beginning that you and I are the lucky ones because of the evidences in these rooms. The last Christmas I drank, I came home at the beginning of December and I said to Karen, I said, you know, if I only had a dapple gray Arabian horse, I think I could stop drinking, you know. And she looked strange to say the least. And I bought this beautiful dapple gray Arabian horse. And we had to look at the picture, you know. I went up to a London shop in Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills and bought my outfit. It was a beautiful English Stetson hat and a Harris tweed jacket and English yard purse, Spanish cane, and I wore my father's monocle. I looked really good, you know. And the horse had a new English saddle and a Kimberwick bits, special reins and stirrups, and a martingale. You know what a martingale is? It's a little leather strap, goes from the cinch up, has 2 chrome rings, the reins go through, and if the horse has a habit to throw his head back and knock the rider off the saddle, you know, that's why you have that martingale. That horse didn't have that problem at all. I just thought it looks so goddamn good, you know. Yeah. I was sober for 2 days with him, day and a half. With that thing, the first day, you know, we had a border a block away from where we lived in Anaheim, then in Orange Grove. That was 28 doors, you know, and it was a good place to have it. And I should show them what I could do, you know. And I'm cantering around there in the corral, you know, and there was all 4 kids, and Karen stood out and she said, Jesus. That's exactly how I looked in Stockholm when I met him. The next day I had 14 martinis for lunch and I fell off the horse too, you know. That was the whole thing with that deal. 2 days before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous was a Sunday morning at 10 o'clock at Trifty Mart. I was picked up trying to steal a pint of liquor for $3.57. You should have seen me then. I was drunken and shaven. I weighed 246 pounds. I couldn't even defend myself. I just stood on wimp, but it can't be me. Look where I came from. And I was brought up in a beautiful family under the most favorable circumstances. But that morning in Anaheim, I looked exactly like a person who has to steal a pint of liquor to live, you know. 2 days after that, Karen stood down and looked at me and she said, you know, for years, because of the children, we have stayed together. But now, because of them, we have to part. And either you go down and try that thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, or you have to move out again. And I'd been kicked out before. And I just went down to the Dalana Club because I didn't want to be kicked out. And I came in, there was an old lady behind a coffee bar, was absolutely lovely, Josephine was her name. And she said, do you have a drinking problem? I said, no, get along famously with it. Can you do something for my wife? She's crazy. And that's how it is when we come in here. We don't know this is going to work, and we got to cover on. But I tell you another thing. If I had known how sick I was when I came in, I would never have stayed. For stopping drinking wouldn't have fixed that. And you know, and that's a fact. You know, many of us, had we known in what a bad spot we are in when we come in, we would do something more drastic. But there's a line in the big book that covers us, more will be revealed, and thank God for that line. And by the grace of God, everything happened to me the next day. I was up early that morning, I went out and drank my codeine cough medicine with whiskey. I drove down to the Alana Club and walked into the club there and polished off a pint of Seagram 7 on my 10-minute trip down to the club. Come in there, I said, please call Karen and tell her I'm here already, you know. And then I proceeded to tell these guys why I couldn't be alcoholic, you know. Living in a beautiful home with a swimming pool, I have 3 automobiles and an English bulldog, dapple gray Arabian down there. I play a little music, I fantasize a little bit, for God's sake, but that sure can't be alcoholism. There was one guy that stood on and looked at me and said, that son of a bitch will never make it, you know. And then I went out and I had 4 double martinis for lunch, you know, and came back and said, will you please call Karen again, tell her I'm here for the second time to show how sincere I was, you know. And then it happened. There's a pamphlet called The Members' Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alan McGinnis wrote it. He was a screenwriter. It's probably the finest pamphlet we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, what goes on in these rooms. Wherever we go for help, you know what's wrong with you. You know what's wrong with you. Then they tell us, wherever we go. The first time in the miracle that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous, they come in, the newcomer come in and says, hi, do you know what was wrong with me? And this is what I have done about it. We don't put the newcomer on the defensive. Like you said to Chuck Chamberlain, come on in, you're in the right place, have a cup of coffee. And those guys rocked me to sleep, you know. And what happened after me that afternoon, this guy had been standing there listening to me all morning. They didn't say a thing. I like to tell you, I hear many people say I was very arrogant and I told everybody to go to hell, and you know, and I had a thing. I tell you, I did the best I knew all my life, and it still beat life. It really is discouraging, you know. And this guy, he says, Johnny, why don't you come home with me and let us talk? I said, okay. It was so pathetic, you know. You know. And Charlie Vick was his name, and he was my sponsor. And we sat in his patio and he told me his story. And that's what I think is important in Alcoholics Anonymous. One drunk talking to another. The identification between the two. When he was true with his story, I realized he was worse than I was. And he depended more than I did on it. And he was sober. I said, you go that way and you don't have to drink no more. That's right. And I knew he was telling the truth. But I tried to wiggle out of it one more time. I said, you don't understand. Every time I stop drinking, I get the shakes. And weird things happen to me when I stop drinking. And he said, Johnny, you will only shake for 4 or 5 days. Then you never have to shake again as long as you live. And I sat down and I said, Jesus, what information this guy is coming up with here, you know. And then he told me about the disease of alcoholism. He called it an allergy of the body coupled with the obsession of the mind. And he said, the first drink is a mental one to make you comfortable. And then the body takes over and creates more blue. You cannot control your drinking pattern or your behavior. And things started to fall in place for me, you know. I went to a meeting that night. And when they read portion of chapter 5 that we all do at our meetings out in Southern California, I just said, please, God, help me today to stay sober. It wasn't a big deal, you know. I always thought the spiritual experience would be something like, yes, Ron, what can I do for you, you know. But it wasn't anything like that. It was merely a feeling. And my thoughts were these, that perhaps after all this dies away for me too. When I came home tonight, I said to Karen, I said, you know, it happened to me tonight. I don't have to drink anymore. And she stood on and looked and said, your eyes look different. I haven't had a drink of alcohol or any codeine, cough medicine, or strange pills or funny cigarettes since that day. And it's 38 years or 9 months ago and 20 days ago. Yeah. And you are new. You must sit down and say to yourself, it must be easy for you to have all that time on the program. But it wasn't easy then, and that's what we are dealing with right now. You know, I was not a great success when I came in here. I had a lot of anxieties about my kids. I wanted to be a good father. I knew I wasn't most of the time. I was $36,000 in the hole. They were all small bills. They were all due. And Karen's suicide attempt drove me crazy. It's hard to live with yourself when you realize that you have broken another human being's spirit. But I didn't drink and I went to meetings. And that's all I had going here for quite a while. But I just like to tell you all new, those first 2 months of my sobriety, I couldn't handle nothing. When the phone rang at home, I just pointed at it. I said, and then I split and hid in my closet. I was scared to death about those phone calls. I had 10 days of sobriety. I sat in the stag meeting and blurted it out. I said, you guys don't understand, but I feel so goddamn guilty. And that was an old timer that said, the reason you feel so guilty is because you're guilty. And there were guys like that that saved my life. First, I could admit it was my fault, my wrongs, without anything else, you know. I realized that whatever they had done or she had done or said, I drove them to it. When I took it on that basis, I was free. And I realized too that I had a clarity that I could see exactly where I was, that all the things that were wrong for the first time in my life, alcohol was involved in that. It had to do with the drinking. I knew I had no more rights to go back to drinking. I knew whatever happened, I couldn't go back to drinking. You know, I had done enough damage, no more rights. So I had taken the first 2 steps on this point and didn't know it. But how do you turn your will and life over to care of God as you understand Him? What's the spiritual experience in these rooms? That happened to me moments later the same evening. As I stood all alone and afraid, this guy came up to me. I never saw him before. And he just comes over and put his arm around me and said, Johnny, everything is going to be all right. And I believed him. And that's how it began for me with a higher power. It's just like those guys in my welfare talk. It's trusted them. For quite a while, those same guys gave me the courage to face my wrongs and my difficulties. And they talked to me in a fashion I never experienced before. They didn't point fingers. There was no judgment. They just shared their own experiences from heart to heart. And this love and this care that goes on in these rooms is really the most healing commodity that we can offer being offered. It suits us back the good health and the gifts as a God of our very own. And it's happened to everybody. Nobody is excluded. Karen didn't believe I was going to stay sober when I came in. It took 2 years of sobriety before she realized I meant business. And you know, we come in and we hoped they would believe us, but I understood another thing. She didn't dare to believe it. Because the last 4 years I drank, well, I was in the wagon several times when I had these ultimatums. And every time we became friends, 2-3 weeks down the line when we became friends, I always went back to drinking. So she didn't dare to believe I was going to stay sober. And you see, when it comes to trust, it's nothing we can demand. It's something we have to earn. And that's what the day and the time is all about. And besides that, there's a lot of stuff that's going on between you and me in these rooms. We come in here, you're doing fine, hang in, that's going to get better. And we have this whole support group here. And we don't have to go through nothing alone anymore. It's incredible. I had 60 days of sobriety when Charlie says to me, sobriety got to be the number one in your life. And I said, no, my kids come first. I love them all my own life. Charlie said, without sobriety, you won't have them. And you have a letter in your pocket to prove it, which was true because I was kicked out at the time. I said, well, then my business, I got to pay them bills. And Charlie said, you drank up at Ore Factory. 36 grand in the hole right now, whatever you're doing, if you don't stay sober, you're going to blow that too. And every year, but I came up with, he plugged it. I really, it's true. Without sobriety, I don't have a chance at all. And then he says, there's no conditions on sobriety. I said, what do you mean no conditions? If she could forgive me, my job started to go better, I could consider this damn thing. And Charlie said, there's no condition on sobriety because one of the conditions you come up with might not come true. Then you blame AA for it and go back to drinking again. And you know, how many times have we heard this? You know, I tried AA, it didn't work for me. You know, and I mean, we have conditions. And you know, ladies and gentlemen, for one reason or I bought the package. So now my sobriety is the number one in my life. There's no condition on sobriety. Then something happens to us when we come to these rooms because it's just like we open up a little bit. And I'm up early, I go to work early. She met me in the hallway, you know, and said, well, before you had a booze all the time as a crutch, now you have those damn meetings. Are you kind of that kind of weakling, you can't stand on your own 2 feet? I said, I suppose so. And then I go to work all day, and I come home 4:15, have dinner before I go to my meeting. I have 25 phone calls about the people I owe the money to. I had no money, I had no income yet of 60 days of sobriety, you know. And I was not in a place where I could write a check for 36 grand and say, take it and shove it and don't bug me anymore, you know. I had no money, so I called my sponsor. I said, Charlie, they want my money. And he said, no, Johnny, they want their money. He said, So, tell you what happened. I went on a strict budget, and I worked very hard, and I bought money orders twice a month. Took me 4.5 years to pay back that $36,000. And when I had paid it back, there was no resentment, because I had bought my freedom. And it was a very important part of my sobriety is financial amends, you know. And Bill and Bob talked about it. The first day they went down and talked to the people they owe money to and can't pay you right now. So it must be an important thing. But that's how that happened. So now this evening I had a quick bite to eat. I come down here to a meeting. I have a reprieve here for 1.5 hours. Then I go home and I'm supposed to thank God for my sobriety that day. And I lay down in my bed and I said, God, What a terrible day I've had. What an absolutely terrifying day I've had. I said, yeah, but I didn't drink. I said, what's going on? I used to get drunk over a lot less. And then it begins, because then we start to realize that this thing called sobriety, it's mine. It's my own. It's the only decent thing that has happened to me in a long time. It must be some sort of a gift or something. Then begins a consistency in our living, and then we add to it. And from now on, everything is God's business, good and bad. And if he's caught part of the bad stuff becomes a period within a period. And when we are going through that period, we realize why we had to go through, and it all starts to make sense. So this thing called sobriety, it's a big deal. But there's more to than that. The admission and the acceptance is part of that gift. It says in chapter 3, we have to concede to our innermost self we are alcoholic. That's the first step of recovery. The admission and the acceptance and the sobriety itself, those three things to me is a divine intervention. Because 9 out of 10 alcoholics never make it because they don't buy what I'm talking about. 9 out of 10 alcoholics either die or go crazy from this thing because they don't buy what I'm talking about. 9 out of 10 alcoholics have periods of sobriety, go in and out of care units, in and out of treatments, in and out of meetings, rooms, alcoholics, because they don't buy what I'm talking about. It's a fact. And then today we have addicts, alcoholics. What's the difference? A heroin addict doesn't identify with the people on coke. The people on coke feel superior to alcoholics. For one reason or another, maybe the price tag have a little bit of snob appeal, I don't know. Don't worry, I'm making a point about alcoholics. So they say if I had a program like Alcoholics and Coke Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, have a lot of credibility today, help a lot of people who have a problem with those things. But what's wrong with us? Why is it only 1 out of 10 of us that has a consistency in sobriety? It's like Clancy said, my case is different. I don't really identify like alcoholics like them. You know? And it's a fact. And I stood out at night and I said, why? Why was I so lucky that I saw it and grabbed and ran with it? Why didn't my brothers? They needed us as much as I did. How many people have you and I tried to 12-step over the years and help them this thing? They don't want what we got. It's incredible. And one more thing about alcoholics. Now, what is the difference? An addict is trying to get out of reality. You and I are trying to fit into reality. But the recovery program is the same. Total abstinence and the 12 steps. And I have watched you addicts now for over 30 years. You don't seem to drink a hell of a lot better than we did, you know. So join what you're supposed to join. We can't beat this rap, you know. So here I am. My sobriety is right. My AA life is good. My work start to go better. The kids come home from school. Hi, Dad, can we talk? Now the kids are in place. Every day you and I stay sober, life is getting better in spite of us. And there have been days in my life, the only thing that was right that day was that I didn't drink that day. And it's worthwhile to fight, so don't give up before the miracle happens. And then 2 years later, Karen comes to me. And she said, you know, it wasn't always your fault. I said, now I can die, you know. Long ago, you know, she said, you know, this life we live today is really the most fabulous adventure. And it was so hopeless and tragic at one time, it's completely turned around. There's even a degree of innocence between us today. And that's almost impossible to believe, but that has come to pass because she is just as busy in Al-Anon as I'm in AA. We have seen so many people over the years have turned around and started to be good to one another. Nothing is in vain. all that bad stuff is going to benefit somebody else down the line, so don't even worry about it right now. And sometimes you and I wonder, what kind of amends can I make them to make everything right now? There's no profundity here. Has nothing to do with intention, promises. We can't bribe them no more. It doesn't matter how many good things you and I do. When we come home drunk, it's all canceled out. It means nothing. The only amends we can make to ourselves and our loved ones is stay off the booze a day at a time. The rest of the program will follow little by little, but we got to start somewhere. So, here we are. Now, the first thing that I had a problem with, you know, when my sponsor said that I had to take my inventory, I said, it means nothing. It won't help. You know, I was 90 days sober and took an inventory. I took her inventory and my older brother's. I came out pretty good. But I had 14 months of sobriety when Charlie said, you know, and I had such a bad attitude about it. He said, you ain't going to stay sober if you don't make your inventory and write it up. I said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to prove to you it means nothing. And that was my attitude when I wrote my fourth step, you know, and I wrote it down. And I said, Charlie, it's finished. Come over here and take the fifth step. I came over down and I read my fifth step. And the strangest thing, you know, after I had read that to him, I had a feeling like I had fulfilled the contract for sobriety. I didn't have to worry about getting drunk again. Another thing I had encountered on was that I had a deep feeling that God had forgiven me for all those bad things. I'd never counted on that. I also realized that, you know, caring for the kids, they have some problems in some areas. And if I should straighten them out, use common sense or logic to tell them where they were wrong, I was going to make it worse instead of better for them, and they had to defend it even more so. So I learned how to stay out of that stuff. And when I didn't react to it, their fear about those things got less and less. And then Karen talked to her sponsor, and she got free, you know. And that's how it is, you know. We have to give up that control, you know, my sponsor taught me. Another thing that I hadn't counted on, in my inventory I saw all my defects and shortcomings. And throughout my life I had made the same mistakes in the same... I could never admit I was wrong. I could never... You know, I couldn't do this or make that. I had to prove that I could do it, you know, and on and on and on. And I realized finally, I said, God, I denied all my life that I am like that. But now I realize that's precisely what I am and who I am, and that I can do nothing about them things, and you will remove them in your time and your terms. And then I turned that over to God. You see that. Many people say, I hear sometimes, they say, I go home and work on my defects of character and shortcomings. The more we work on it, the worse it's going to get. And that is the fact in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we have to have a power greater than ourselves. There is no such thing as an intellectual solution to an obsession. We have to have a power greater than ourselves. It was the first thing that... When Lois asked the doctor, what's going to happen to Bill? If he doesn't have a spiritual experience, he's going to die drunk. And, you know, he had a spiritual experience. And you and I, we have a process of experience when we start to take the 12 steps and put them into our lives and change our ways and ask for directions and have a sponsor to talk to and study the book and so on. You know, and it is a beautiful thing, you know. And, you know, so... And if there's anybody sitting here tonight and they talk about, well, I should really write my inventory, I'll give you a little help. There's a long form and a short form, you know. Do this first. First write down the four things you have decided not to tell anybody, even of severe torture. It will save you 62 pages of writing, you know. Everything is God's business. everything, good and bad, right or wrong, you know. It doesn't matter. It has to be like that for us. And, you know, we are the most fortunate people as far as I'm concerned, you know. Now, the biggest thing we seem to have, all of us, is resentments, you know. And I want to tell you something. I had a resentment against my older brother that knew no bounds. He was 1 year and 9 months older than I was. But he hated me with a passion. I never understood why. You know, when he was 12 years old, he was over 6 feet. He weighed over 200 pounds. And he used to punch me out, and I rolled under the dining room table and pretended I had fainted so he wouldn't hit me anymore. He was an enormous guy, and I was not big like that at all. I couldn't handle it. And he had a photographic mind. He had an IQ galore, and he was unbelievably successful in his life, you know. And I sat down. I'm supposed to have to forgive him. How can I forgive him for that? He drowned me when I was 13 years old. He was a water polo player, you know. You know, and we were out there at the ocean outside where we lived in Malmo in Sweden, at the 15 feet depth, and he just grabbed me by the hair and put me under and held me there till I heard my father's voice talking to me from the other side. I tell you, it's a terrifying thing to drown. And I lay down and I said, why did he hate me so much, you know? And am I supposed to be some sort of a second-class citizen because I have joined this thing and say, I forgive you and I love you, you know. I'd like, please give me some directions. And one guy said, try to understand you, I said. And it was a fluke. I changed it. I said, how did I interfere in his life? And it was just like I saw a film. You know, when I was 3 years old and he was 5 years old, he was obese, and he was not a lap baby, you know. And when I was 3 years old, I was absolutely adorable. And my father used to lift me up in the air and hug me and kiss me and carry on with me. And then my brother stood next to him. What about me? But he was not the lap baby. And I mean, the whole thing cleared like I was like a bombshell. I said, my God, that's the whole deal. He is so serious and such an introvert. And he needed more life than I did, and I was in the way. And I sat down and I thought, how can I handle this? How can I tell him he doesn't have to worry about it anymore, you know? And I sat down that night and I think, all his life, the only thing he wanted, the purpose of him living was to get the approval from our dad. And he died when he was 9, so he couldn't get it. You know, here is this obese, big, fat guy, you know, and when he came into junior high school, he took gymnastics 7 days of the week. Became one of the finest athletes in Sweden in skiing and gymnastics and water polo. He was on a water polo team in the Olympics. He carried Swedish flag in the Olympics. You see this 6'4" guy coming down with a flag in his hands. He was a stunning guy. He was an officer and a gentleman. He lived in a castle outside Stockholm, you know, same like my father grew up. I said, he has done all this thing, and he only wanted the approval from our father. He can't get it because he died when he was 9. And I said, how can I straighten this out? And you know, I hadn't heard from my brother then for 15 years. Call this what you want. The next day I had a long letter from him. And point for point, what I had been thinking about the night before, he had paragraph after paragraph saying, do you remember how we should honor our parents, how great they were, and this is what I've done, and all these things he had done, and he couldn't get the approval. And I said, that was the whole purpose of life. So I just wrote this little note to him. I said, dear Bertin, if our father had been alive today, he would have taken you in his arms and said, you have succeeded beyond my greatest expectations, loving brother John. And amazing, you know. I haven't had a resentment since. But you know what happened that I hadn't counted on? I lost my inferiority complex. You know, we never know. You and I are motivated and driven to take these steps. And I assure you, I didn't come to this conclusion and did all that exercise of searching and praying to God to find an answer for this thing. I was full of hate. I was not a loving, wonderful guy. I did it strictly under pain. And you know, I didn't say, I forgive you for drowning me. He might have blown his brains out. I didn't play God. I made amends to him for how I had interfered in his life. And that's what it's all about, you know. And you know what happened between us? He wrote me every month until he died what he was doing, and we became the dearest friends. And it was a gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, boy. Well, you know, it's 10:15. I have this Rolex here, you know. You know, you don't know, it's 32 years old, you know. She gave it to me. You know, it drives the old-timers crazy when you go a little overtime here. I have a friend in Glendale, his name is Bob Lemke, and he's a full-blooded German. And I had a little problem with the Germans during the war, you know. Well, I knew Bob for 4 years, and I realized I loved him. He's a great AA, 12-step a lot, help a lot of people. He has done it all these years. And, you know, for the last 22 years, I have been invited to speak on his birthday in Glendale. But the first time I was there, he is one of those, like, you don't save any souls after 10, you know. And I had a minute and a half to wrap up my story. And, you know, he even talks funny, you know. You know, he's actually born here, has more of an accent than I have. He must practice something every night, you know. It's 10 o'clock and he sits at the front, at the door down, and he shouts at me. I'm a minute and a half to wrap up my story. John, for God's sake, it's 10. Said, Lemke, this is only an AA meeting. We ain't marching into Poland tonight, you know. You know, so this life that you and I live here, lead here, we had somebody named Chuck Chamberlain that was amongst us all those years, and he showed us what's going on in these rooms. It's called love with no conditions. Love with no conditions. You and I can be who we are and what we are, and in spite of it we are loved. There's nothing like it on the face of this earth. And then this ism we have, it makes us belong. We belong to each other. The sense of belonging in these rooms at times is haunting. It's a fact and reality. Alone we cannot do it, but together we can. The room, the group, the fellowship we carry when we can't care for ourselves. It's a beautiful thing, you know. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, the American Medical Association, they said that alcoholism is the number one killer, the second contributor to insanity. That's what you and I are dealing with here. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, there were 300,000 sober members in AA. Today, 2 million a week goes to AA meetings in 145 countries. That's what you and I are involved in here. One alcoholic talking to another, you know. And I like to tell you, my Karen and I, she was 17 when I met her. We've been married 54 years. It's great, you know, to have that kind of, we have fun together. We have, you know. And we have done this for a long time, you know, and we have fun when we aren't here, you know. And a few years ago, it's so simple. We don't have to, I could never, if she had another opinion, I had to tell her what she was wrong, you know. I mean, that was something wrong. And today, when she has another opinion, I said, how interesting. What a concept. A few years ago, she stood out and said, hey, fella, you know, I think if you want, I think I'll run away with you. You know, and it is so simple and easy between us, and there are no strings here, you know. It is just freedom galore here, you know. And the kids, they were 13, 10, and 8, and 6 when I came in here. Now, I was so fortunate to come in at that early age, so I've been their father for all these years. And you know, to tell you, I taught them how to swim and dive and play tennis. They inherited that horse. They had him for more than 10 years, and I taught them how to write English and a little dressage and a little jumping, you know. I experienced everything with them that I wish my father could have experienced with me. And it is just like I have sensed my dad's presence here all these years, this journey in alcoholics, all those things that I had such problem with emotionally, it has completely, I just feel like any time I think of him and my mom, they think of me too and us too. And I know it is, I haven't lost nothing, you know. It's just a fantastic thing to live this life, you know. And you all knew, if you can just believe this, we only wish you well, and we only want good things for you. If you can just believe that and take that, you will never wake up lonely anymore, because you know by now there is a way to go and to live, you know. Now, how these 12 steps, this formula for living, there is nothing like it. You know, I lived out there. I never was part. I never fitted in. I was somebody else. You know, why couldn't I be more like him and that, da 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 da? And today, thanks to this way of life, you and I, we live out there, we participate, we fit in. I'd be so bold to say, we live out there like we don't have the illness. American medical is the number one killer, the second contributor to insanity. That's what you and I are dealing with. And here, we live out there like we don't have the illness. And I like to say, think about that for the people that have heart and cancer. You and I are no victims. We have an opportunity to participate in life and living, that we just live one another and have time to help one another to live. Nobody have the breaks that you and I have. And lastly, I like to say this, that, you know, that I can't for a moment believe that God would take us through all those things and then bring us in here and show us this way to live if he didn't have any plans for us. It really wouldn't make any sense at all. And we sit down, we say, his will, my will, what should I pick? Be this simple. You know, abstinence is a spiritual environment. It isn't natural for alcoholics not to drink. But as long as you and I have abstinence, we have a chance. Because we sit here and we have our sponsor. You know, Charlie died when I was 31, when I had had him my sponsor 31 and a half years. Then I asked John Haley, an ex-priest of mine, he'll be my sponsor the last 8 years, you know. And he is equally wonderful as Charlie on one and one. He has taught him about prayer and meditation in the quiet time, you know. And he's beautiful. And Karen talked about, she thought I was going to have some written test when I came in here. And when I asked, you know, John Haley to be my sponsor, and I had his first meeting with him, Karen said, how was the meeting with John Haley? And I said, I understand I have to make some written test. Now, you know. No, things are just terrific. And so you are new. You know, we sit here in these rooms, and we identify, and we have these moments of clarity, you know, and everything falls in place, and you know, and it, to me it was like, as long as I didn't drink, everything is going to be all right down the line. I didn't have to worry about nothing. At least I'm doing this right, and you see, and so you all knew, do this, do what we do, don't drink and come to meetings. It's the best deal in town. Thank you.